and everybody's heard about the bird. Rick Shefchik, author of the new book, Everybody's Heard About the Bird, takes you behind the scenes of rock and roll culture, fueled by teen spirit and top 40 radio. It took the nation by storm in the 1960s, and Rick's got special behind the scenes, up close and personal looks at the Minnesota bands that made the right connections at the right time to make it big on the national scene. I was certainly immersed in the whole 60s scene, the promoters, the venues. The decade itself was really something musically and culturally. It couldn't have been more different than it started. And here to tell us all about the bird, the dog, and the rest of the Twin Cities rock and roll scene is Mr. Rick Shefchik. Welcome to the Roadhouse, Rick.
Thank you, Dave. Good to be here.
Wow, what a book. And I've been joking with all my friends. I'm only 43, so it took me behind the curtain of a bygone era that I know a lot of boomers, a lot of friends up here were almost right there. And if you could just give us a little insight into what inspired you to write this book and what the scene looked like back in the 60s.
Sure. Well, what inspired me was the music. I grew up with it. I'm from Duluth originally, but we had all those songs on the radio. You know, most of the bands that were really successful out of Minnesota were from the Twin Cities. You know, they were playing not only the teen clubs in the Twin Cities metro area, but they would tour all over the state. You know, you'd get the Trashmen and the Underbeats and the Castaways up in Duluth, up on the Iron Range. They would promote their records. I grew up in that era where those songs were part of the soundtrack. They were part of the mix that you would hear on any radio station in the state. And it occurred to me that nobody had written a book about all of these bands and about how they came to prominence and how they related with each other. And in many cases, there was some kind of cross-pollination there because they would leave one of these well-known bands and join another one. And since nobody had written a book, I decided that I would do it.
Well, it seems more than a book, Rick. It's an anthology. It's a chronological decade in retrospective, and it's the album covers and the promotional materials. Some of the photography is amazing. How did you research all this? How long did it take you to bring this all together?
Well, I guess I'd say close to 2 years. But in some sense, I was preparing to write this book almost all of my life because, you know, I've been accumulating the music, and it's much easier to do that now than it used to be. Let's take Soma Records, for instance, where most of the most familiar hits came out of. Soma Records in Minneapolis, owned by the Heiliger Brothers. Those, the most prominent hits you could usually find. You could find a copy of the Trashmen album, Surf and Bird, and you could find 45s of the most famous songs like Liar Liar or Run, Run, Run. But now that YouTube exists, the beautiful thing is that you can go about as deeply into the catalogs of these bands as you want and find almost everything that they've recorded in one form or another, not necessarily always in the best fidelity, but, you know, as I'm researching, let's say, the Underbeats, I know that a couple of the songs that I was familiar with at the time are available on a 2-CD set of Soma's Greatest Hits that was released a while ago. But now on YouTube, you can find basically both sides of every single that the Underbeats recorded, and some of that material is just wonderful music that unfortunately didn't really turn out to be hit.
Well,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's kind of counter to my experience here at the radio station, Rich, as far as... you know, I was trying to find music for this, and I couldn't even find the Trashmen in our music library. I don't know if that's a poor reflection on us, but I did have a large 60s best of hits catalog, and believe it or not, I had a hard time finding a lot of these acts on that national sort of Billboard Top 10 compilation. Is that strange? Is that an anomaly? What happened there where I couldn't even find this stuff on our local shelf?
Well, it sort of goes back to the problem that Soma had back in the early to mid-60s, and that was that they had a great distribution network in the upper Midwest because the Heiliger brothers were based in Minneapolis. They were able to get their product out all over Minnesota, and they owned a chain of record stores called Musicland, and that's where the Heilikers made most of their money. And to them, for a while, having a record label like Soma and having part ownership of the recording studio K-Bank in Minneapolis was sort of a sidelight. It wasn't a way that they really expected to make a whole lot of money or base their business. So they, once their records started to become pretty popular, they had several that went to number one in the Twin Cities, and a few of them really became nationally popular, but they didn't get distribution all over the country because the Heilikers didn't have a network that went into every market as strongly as the ones where they were based. And I think that that's almost reflected today in the fact that when you go out and look at these collected hits of the 60s, stuff from Soma usually is not included on those collections, and it's probably, again, sort of the old distribution issue. And part of it, too, I suppose, is licensing. You never know for sure who owns the rights to some of these songs, and I do know that in the past, the Heilikers have been a little tight-fisted with letting some of these songs get out of their grasp. So, they're just not as prevalent as a lot of the more familiar oldies.
Well, and you certainly touch on that in your book as far as the magic ingredients that need to occur for bands to go big. And it's not just talent, it's connections and distribution and DJs. And that was my favorite part, Rick. I'm, of course, a DJ here at the station and always held DJs in high regards as personalities and entertainers. And it certainly was the time of the 60s and the top 40 DJ. And could you talk about Bill Deal for all our listeners that aren't familiar with Bill and his fine work?
Sure, I'd be happy to. To begin with, Bill's a friend of mine. I've known him since 1980 when I started working at the St. Paul Pioneer Press. And Bill is first and foremost a newspaper man. He started working for the St. Paul newspaper back in, he was actually a delivery boy in the 30s. But after he graduated high school in the 40s, he went to work for them, became a movie columnist, and then kind of made a gradual transition to radio as almost a sidelight. He never left his newspaper job until after his radio career had pretty much wound back down to being a part-time job. But in 1957, he was hired by WDGY to become a top 40 disc jockey, which is sort of a new thing at the time. This was a format that really hadn't been tried excessively anywhere. And it turned out to be really successful, mostly, because, in 57, the music was becoming very exciting. Elvis Presley, Buddy Holly, the Everly Brothers, Little Richard. It was a phenomenal time for all of these acts to get exposure. But then you had the disc jockeys that were kind of fast-talking, hip lingo, slinging, just so much fun to listen to. And Bill Deal was the best of them all in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, he was the Raja of the records, right?
The purveyor of the platters. Wizard of the wax, purveyor of the platters. Yes, he had that patter down cold. He was so good at it.
Rock and roll legend.
Yep.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Rick Sheffick, and he is the author of a new book, Everybody's Heard About the Bird. Of course, that's a play up on the Trashmen and their rock and roll hit, The Surfin' Bird. And that seemed to be the big one of the Minnesota bands, at least initially. And could you give us an idea, Rick, of just how big a hit that Surfin' Bird was and what its impact was on the local music scene?
Yeah, when Surfin' Bird was released in the fall of 1963 on Soma Records, it sold 38,000 copies in its first week, and that's just in essentially Minnesota and probably primarily in the Twin Cities. So it was a phenomenon. And then it first hit the national charts in December of 1963 and pretty much had the same effect. When kids all over the country heard this record, they just flipped for it. It was unlike anything they'd ever heard before. It had this propulsive drumming. It had kind of this goofy nonsense lyric to it, with a funny, gruff sounding vocal delivery. And the record ended up peaking at number 4 nationally in late January of 1964, which was the week before the Beatles hit number 1 for the first time with I Want to Hold Your Hand. So the Beatles and the Trashmen were essentially ranked 1 and 2 for the most popular rock bands in the United States at that very moment. And, of course, as we all know, the Beatles just continued to get bigger and bigger. And for the Trashmen, the overall direction was kind of in the opposite direction.
Well, and you know, the Beatles, I think, was a game changer in terms of style and direction. And why was that? Do you have any insight on the British beat and if it was just the teens and how they just need something new every year?
Well, it's really interesting to note that the musicians that I write about in the book, and well, let's take the Trashmen, for instance, they were all contemporaries of both the Beatles and Bob Dylan, all basically born within the same few years in the early 40s, all grew up listening to the same music, those 50s artists that I just mentioned, Elvis Presley, Buddy Holly, Everly Brothers, huge influence on the kids who came along a little bit later. They were all listening to the radio, learning the music off of the same records. And the difference, I think, was that the Beatles appreciated what they were hearing from these American artists, but they put a different spin on it. The beat was accentuated a little bit more. The guitars were probably a little bit more prominent, a little bit more forward. There might have been a little bit more of an R&B blues take on what these original American recordings had sounded like. And then the other thing to keep in mind is that the Beatles had two of the greatest songwriters of all time, John Lennon and Paul McCartney, and a third, George Harrison, who could also write a pretty good song. And that's where they separated themselves from the American bands like the Trashmen and some of the other ones from the Twin Cities who had the same influences but didn't have the same songwriting abilities that the Beatles did. And that generally made the difference between a band that that might have one or two hits and a band that would have a career.
Well, the Trashmen, Surfin' Bird, ended up being sort of a novelty hit, right? They became, I don't want to say one-hit wonders. They had a second follow-up that I think charted.
And yeah, King of the Surf was their second. King of the Surf was the B-side, and that did well, too.
Yeah.
Then Bird Dance Beat was the follow-up record, and that made it to number 30 in the charts. And that was the last time that the Trashmen made the national charts. And again, there's an example. Bird Dance Beat was something thrown together by their manager, George Garrett, to try to imitate Surfin' Bird. And it's a fun record, but it didn't take the Trashmen any place that they hadn't already been. And forever afterwards, they just weren't able to find another song to capture the public's attention.
Well, and it was a fickle public of 13-year-old teenage girls, right?
You know. Well, yeah, at one point in the book, I think I quoted Warren Kendrick, the producer who wrote songs and produced for the Electras from Ely, who said that it was 13-year-old girls who bought records, and so that's who you had to write for.
It's crazy you mentioned the Electras, Rick. I got Dirty Old Man lined up for our listeners. So.
Oh, what a great song.
Yeah.
I was lucky to talk to a lot of these people for my book, and Warren Kendrick was one of the people that granted me an extensive interview, and I learned so much talking to him. You know, he was just a drive-in operator from a western suburb of the Twin Cities, who played sort of a rudimentary guitar, but wanted to be involved in the music business and got some ideas about songwriting. He ended up at Dove Studio when the Electras called up Dove saying that we want to come down to the Twin Cities and record a couple of songs. Do you have anybody willing to work with us? And Kendrick basically just sort of picked up the phone because nobody else was in the office and answered that phone call. And he said, yeah, come on down. I'll produce you. And he ended up being the producer of some of the best kind of angry Yardbirds-y sort of original songs that ever came out of Minnesota. He also worked with The Litter, who did a number of his songs. He's somebody that's really not all that well remembered anymore, but hopefully when you hear a song like Dirty Old Man you realize how talented he was.
Well, your story about Chuck Berry taking the Escapades under his wing on New Year's Eve, 1964, is one of my favorites. And could you share some of the highlights with our listeners on that fateful night?
Yeah, well, the Escapades, a lot of people have told me that's their favorite story in the book. These are four guys from St. Louis Park. They're from Highland Park, St. Paul, who had been in a surf band and had realized that, playing Ventures instrumentals just wasn't making it anymore after the Beatles hit. So they bought human hair, long-haired wigs, and basically disappeared for 3 months to practice nothing but British Invasion songs, and then came out on New Year's Eve 1964 opening for Chuck Berry, passing themselves off as a British band when actually they were from St. Paul. And Chuck Berry was used to these one-night stands, but these guys were just so thrilled to have the gig that it didn't occur to them that they might get stiffed by the promoters. But Chuck Berry said, listen, before you guys play another note, you got to make sure that you get paid. And they said, no, Chuck, it doesn't work that way. What we do here is we finish the gig, and then they pay us afterwards. And he said, these guys aren't going to pay you. So he takes them down to the office where there's a bunch of thugs counting stacks of bills and with guns bulging underneath their jackets. And Chuck walks right in and says, you got to pay these guys or they're not playing. And they said, Chuck, what do you care? You got paid. Why do you care if this British band gets paid? And he says, because I'm not playing unless you pay them. These kids deserve to get paid too. And one of them starts to pull a gun, and Chuck goes into his guitar case and pulls out a bigger gun and finally gets the Escapades their money. But it was quite an eye-opening experience for this young band of St. Paul kids.
Yeah, and what was his best tip of the night as he was walking back to the rest of the work? Right, he said, "Don't tell anyone about this."
Oh, that's right. He said, "I got you your money, but if anybody else asks if you got paid, tell them no, you didn't." And the reason was, after the gig was over, as Chuck predicted, the promoters disappeared, took all the leftover money, and then the concessionaires came up and said, "Did you guys get paid?" Nope. And the cops came up and said, "Did you guys get paid?" Nope. Turns out that everybody else got stiffed, exactly as Chuck Berry predicted. But the Escapades did get their money.
Yeah. What a crazy time. Crazy kids. Well, Rick, one last one, and this is somewhat rhetorical, but why do rock stars always spend their first windfall on sports cars?
That's a good question. I guess you got to think back to the era. Back in the early to mid-60s, car culture was huge. And I suppose that never really changes too much, but you have to realize that, that was the era of the Beach Boys when they went from surfing music to hot rod songs. So everybody was talking about sports cars, about Corvettes and XKEs. So many bands were named after sports cars back then. So when a band like the Underbeats all of a sudden started making some serious money, and they were making serious money, they were making more money than their fathers were on a weekly basis, so they had cash to spend. And, because cars were just so big back then, that was the most obvious way to spend a big chunk of cash, is to go into a dealership and buy a Triumph, buy a Thunderbird, buy a Corvette, buy an XKE, and that's what they did. They all drove sports cars.
Yeah, they liked the attention.
No, yeah, that didn't hurt at all.
Wow.
Being in a rock band and driving a sports car, I think you would have companionship on a Saturday night if you were looking for it.
That has never gone out of style. Well, Rick Shefchik and his book, Everybody's Heard About the Bird, I think is going to be very, very popular amongst the Midwest readers, especially. Are you getting a good response from this, Rick? It's been out a couple months now. I know you had a big opener at the Fetus.
It's been huge. The first printing of the book sold out in just a little over a month after release.
Oh yeah.
The stores reordered. The second printing is out. It's back available again. Selling really well. I'm anticipating a third printing fairly soon. So yeah, it's been enormously successful. It just has tapped into this fantastic well of nostalgia for everybody who grew up in that era.
Yes, and we're about to experience it now as I roll you out with the Trashmen and their big hit. Thanks so much for joining us on the Roadhouse, Rick.
Thanks, Dave. I enjoyed it.
Take care.